This podcast is a London Business School lecture on Dispelling the Myths of Strategy Execution, led by Dominic Holder, Adjunct Professor of Strategy and Entrepreneurship at London Business School. You will learn tips to successfully execute strategy in today's fast-paced business environment.
Thank you so much for that lovely introduction. Here's an open question, a rather leading open question. Does having a great strategy guarantee great results?
No.
Okay. What's missing? It's the how piece, isn't it? Because a lot of the focus has often been on the what. But frankly, what we have to be about, I would argue, if we're looking for that holy grail of strategy people aspire to, that holy grail of competitive advantage, we have to look very much to the how. And I'd argue that there's a simple reason for this. Because there are so many people out there who've been trained in places like this, doing a really good job on the analysis, the formulation of strategy. So if there are so many smart people out there thinking about strategy, communicating strategy, it couldn't possibly be a source of competitive advantage. The competitive advantage has to come, doesn't it, from the more difficult piece, which we all recognize as practitioners, which is where we're making the translation from the idea into action. And again, when I made that rather painful transition, I have to say, from the world of consulting into the corporate world, again, that was precisely the issue. The ideas weren't difficult. It's just, how the heck can you make the right thing happen? And in the last few years at London Business School, I got lured into a room like this. There was a case study about what we were doing in my company, and I got invited to be the rabbit out of the hat. In fact, it's on the program that you were on, the Sloan Fellowship program. It's my first outing in a business school environment. And the professor, the London Business School professor, said, Dominic, why don't you hide at the back of the room? And then the case discussion unfolded, and as it happened, I was in the case. And so the professor said to the class, these were your predecessors, so what should this company do? You know, that's how these case discussions always go. And one of our Sloan fellows, who's now a rather distinguished senior executive, put his hand up and said, well, the first thing I'd do would be to fire this Dominic Holder character. I was sitting where you're sitting, at the back of the room, And the reason, he said, it's obvious. This strategy guy doesn't have a clue how to put anything into action. So I kind of took that as my challenge, which has been unfolding over many years. But what I'd like to do is to put that challenge to all of you. Because if we're saying this how piece, strategy execution, is critical for competitive advantage, and indeed is the source of competitive advantage in a world where great ideas become commonplace, then what is it? Are there any bankers in the room who work for the Royal Bank of Scotland? It's always a very good idea to know.
Getting rid of their dog.
I can see a hand going up close to this. In fact, one of my colleagues wrote a case study about signature processes at the Royal Bank of Scotland in the days of Fred Goodwin. Do you remember Fred Goodwin? Yeah. And Fred had a particular approach to execution along these lines, which he called JDI. You know what JDI stands for?
Just do it.
Apparently, it was a rather ruder version with an extra letter put in. Mind you, a very serious point behind it, because in the end, what we're after when it comes to execution is commitment. And the nature of commitment is that there's an ask and there's a promise. And indeed, we could regard our organization as a network of commitments, and we'd be asking ourselves about the quality of both the ask that we're making as leaders and the promise that's being made to us by the led, or for that matter, by partners, by colleagues. So when we're coming back to the just do it, there's a very important truth concealed in that, which is to say, what's the quality of commitment? Who can I rely on? Who can I rely on to do what needs to get done? Who can I rely on to do what they say they will? Let's keep going. Do we have any other bits in the room? Please.
I believe we have to generate the motivation with the people that will help you implement this strategy.
Can you say a little more about the motivation and where it comes from.
If there is a disconnect, for example, between the people defining and discussing the strategy and the ones that will be implementing, and eventually they were not invited to the discussion, they can undermine the execution of the strategy because they feel out of the group, out of the discussion.
Does that resonate around the room?
Yeah, of course.
And in fact, even in places like this, in the old days, we used to have a course called strategy formulation and another course called strategy implementation, thus perpetuating that divide. And of course, what might we lose? What might we lose if we have that split, that divide? We might lose the motivation. We might lose something else of great value.
Time.
We might lose time. We might lose time, and back to the let's just do it and get it done. And particularly in the VUCA environment, we've been talking about VUCA, yeah. The world of volatility, uncertainty, complexity and ambiguity. Time's not on our side, or perhaps put more positively, the winners are those who can see first and act fastest. So that's what we might lose. But perhaps it's also knowledge, because again, who knows? Is it us? At the very top of organisations, everyone here in the room is in a very senior position. Who is it who's actually in contact with the realities as they unfold? And are we able to ensure that we have that transmission mechanism in place? Let's take a couple more. Again, what is strategy execution?
I guess then once you have the right person who's committed or the right team and they're motivated in the correct manner, then they have to come up with a programme. I guess you have to define in your strategy what is the delivery time scale. And then you need to be able to scale that program as per that delivery time scale, but also create value, so you have to deliver at the right quality as well.
Very good. So you'd be looking to see that there is, in fact, a goal in mind, an outcome in mind. And perhaps we'll recognise this in the room. One of our bugbears might be that although there's something called a strategy, is it an executable strategy? One of my colleagues, a very smart Italian guy called Stefano Torconi, who works with me on our open program, which was mentioned a little earlier at the beginning of the session, executing strategy for results. And Stefano does a lot of work on ensuring that we can define an executable strategy. In essence, it's strategy made simple, because if our strategy takes the form of 120 PowerPoint slides, then the goal is going to be somewhere deeply buried within. And so what we're looking for, even before we come to the question, just how are we going to execute, is whether or not the what has been defined at a level with which we can work. Here are a few thoughts which have come out of our program. When I say our program, our one-week program, Executing Strategy for Results, is very much designed not just as a learning program in the classic sense with someone at the front of the room giving lectures. It's designed much more as an action learning program and with a very pronounced research component to it. So people from your organizations, because a number of you send people onto that program, which we've been running now for about 5 years, they arrive as researchers. So what we ask them to do before they arrive is to carry out a survey within their own organization of execution bottlenecks, execution challenges. And it's a 360-degree survey, so they would be looking at the perspective of the top leadership, of their peers, and those who actually have to do the heavy lifting. And it's the results from that survey, which in effect are the case material, the live case material on that program. And over the years, it's given us some quite striking results. And I have to say, from my standpoint as a professor, the beauty of a program like that is you learn, frankly, I learn, frankly, even more than I teach in the context of a program of that kind. And it's forced us to challenge some preconceptions, and what I've got in mind here that we might discuss, that we might knock around, some of those preconceptions which at times can take the form of myths around strategy execution. And here's one of them, which I believe is a very common myth. We need to be a little bit careful when we say myth, because of course it would be very foolish to say that vertical alignment in our organisations doesn't matter. But perhaps it's a question of emphasis. And the nature of this myth essentially says that at the top of the organisation, we've got some smart people in our strategy department, and it's their job to cascade the strategy down through the organisation. Do you ever hear that term, cascading the strategy? Now, in real life, it's a direction of the flow, and I believe that we do easily gravitate towards this mindset, this view of strategy execution, because typically we have a particular view of organisations. So if we see a firm as a hierarchy, we'll then very naturally think of execution as vertical alignment, because after all, power, knowledge, all those good things might be there at the top. And again, back to your very good point, we then find that the direction of flow is entirely down. We might have a few marketing people in the room. We might be casting their imperial domain over the sales function. But I believe we had a few hand gestures pointing across the room or across the chart, because where we may find, frankly, some of the really major deficits, not so much around vertical alignment. I believe organisations have got pretty good about that because we've been practising it for decades, if not centuries. It's the horizontal coordination that can become a crucial piece. And if we come back to that holy grail of competitive advantage, it's almost tautological to say that you will not get competitive advantage unless you're able to coordinate horizontally, because this is where we're linking resources and skills, it's where we're building solutions, and I find it hard to imagine innovation that works if we're not crossing boundaries. And indeed, perhaps another concern, because what this is doing, in effect, is to, coming right back to where you got us going, is to ask ourselves, what does the network of commitments look like? And it may not map neatly onto the organisational structure. So we may find, and this is famously so for those of you in the tech world, we may find it's individual contributors who have no managerial responsibility whatsoever, who are highly trusted, highly respected, and command those key nodes in the network of commitments. And so we might then want to, if we're wise, understand what that network is like, what the quality of commitments is, and who are those people? We like to call them distributed leaders. Who are the distributed leaders who command those crucial nodes? It goes further, because I would imagine that many of you in the room work in the context of what we might fashionably call an ecosystem. The idea of an ecosystem being that there's an awful lot of action that goes on beyond the boundaries of our business, which isn't necessarily transactional, but which we all depend on. Here's one small example, which is a hopefully not too rare example of a great British technology success story. How many of us know ARM? Quite a few. How many of us in the room have a device on our possession which has ARM technology inside it? And that should be everyone in the room, because if you've got an iPhone, if you've got a Samsung Galaxy, if you have any kind of tablet, you will have an ARM design chipset inside it, because it's that technology which enables the low power consumption, which in turn means that we can miniaturize what we're carrying around and become totally addicted to for every hour of the day. Thank you, ARM, for making that possible. But they made it possible with hardly any employees of their own. It's seen by Intel as one of their biggest challenges, with a fraction of the number of employees on the ARM payroll, because the action is all out there in the ecosystem in terms of countless partners with whom ARM never carries out, in most cases, an actual transaction involving contracts or the exchange of money for services. But the success of ARM is wholly dependent on the quality of those commitments. So we might, if we're wise, want to ask ourselves, what's the quality of those commitments going horizontally as well as vertically in our own organisation? And what's the quality of those commitments as we work with partners outside? Now, on our programme, Executing Strategy for Results, we've collected data around that very set of challenges, which, depending on your point of view, or even mood at this point in the afternoon, is either rather encouraging or rather depressing. First of all, we tend to do pretty well on the vertical dimension. So this is aggregate data from a large number of respondents from a large number of companies that have been on our programme, and in the survey that our participants do before they come on board, we ask the question. We ask the question, who can I rely on to do what they say they will? So our boss will do what she says she will. Well, they're saying 41% all of the time, most of the time. I think we can give the boss a decent tick in the box. When it comes to direct reports, likewise, because my guess is they would stop being direct reports fairly soon if the score was a lot lower. What do you imagine we see when we come, for instance, to colleagues in other units, and partners? But this is what we find. This is aggregate data. Of course, averages are much less interesting than distributions. As we start to tease this apart, we can see some patterns depending on region, regional culture, company size. But that tells me that there is a huge opportunity. And indeed, if competitive advantage comes back to the way in which we're able to link effectively within our organisation, so we don't have that empty box, not in sales, we are actually able to make those connections within the organisation and with partners beyond, then the potential for advantage is huge, precisely because so many organisations struggle with it. And it may well have a bearing on scale, too. Scale and change. So, for example, if we've grown through acquisition, we might then expect precisely that kind of issue. You mentioned personal relationships. And, of course, close personal relationships might, up to a point, be one of the keys to addressing that challenge. But, of course, personal relationships can exclude. And sometimes part of the challenge we've been finding as we dig deeply into this is that there are very strong informal networks, but those informal networks tend to exclude newcomers, particularly an issue when we come to onboarding in the context of M&A, and particularly at rather senior levels. So what we might want to ask ourselves is exactly that question. What's the quality of commitments, not just in the vertical dimension, but as we look across the organisation, and even beyond to partner organisations? Now, here is another myth, and I need to be a little careful here, given where Zara was taking us, because I think you'd like a goal, you'd like a programme. Now, you won't be able to see this from where you're sitting, but if I look very closely at this particular plan, I can see it says, strip roof tiles and battens, break down walls, redig footings, build external porch pillars, contractor to build and float Hordis floor. It sounds like a building or a renovation project. Here's a quote from a rather stern-looking German or Prussian military gentleman. No plan survives first contact with the enemy. Which is then not to say that we don't need plans, but the question is, how might we be able to build in flexibility? Or in particular, how might we be able to build in what I'd call a learning loop? So if we were coming back to a classic approach to strategy and strategy execution, we define our vision, what to become in terms of the internal choices we might make, the external choices out there in the market. Make sense? Classic approach. And then we'd look at where we are today, and then we'd construct a series of steps to get there, rather like the builder was doing when that builder gave me the plan, which is now running a little over a year late and at three times the budget. Anyway, don't get me going on renovations. But this would be, if you like, the classic execution plan They've got to deliver, back to just doing it.
Commit to the plan.
Yeah, and they've got to commit. Okay. But also, when it comes down to that goal, we need to think loop instead of line. Those of you in the software world will be very familiar with the idea, the old idea of waterfall project management, whereas now we take the approach of Scrum. And the proposition here is that we need to think in a less linear way, as the world has just moved on. How do we now make sense of that changing, ambiguous situation? And from there, what are the choices that we're going to make? When we're talking about choice, of course, it's about what we're not going to do as much as what we will do. From making choices back to commitment, how are we going to ensure that the choice has real teeth? There was one large organisation I was working with quite recently where a very senior manager, just below board level, said to me, "Dominic, a board decision is the signal for our debate to begin." And then, what's the missing piece that closes the loop? Yeah, it's the feedback piece. What are we building in there so that we can make those revisions, compare initial assumptions with experience? That way we close the loop. And if we're executing strategy in that volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous world, our ability to go around that loop more effectively and indeed faster than our competitors will be the source of advantage. And for us, this raises to my mind a huge personal behavioural challenge, because any of us in the room, I bet, are more drawn to one aspect of that execution loop than others. So there'll be some of us in the room who just love brainstorming and making sense. And then there'll be others who actually like to have a really sharp-edged debate. Let's define some real crisp-edged options, get them on the table. There'll be those who've got little patience for the debate and just, you know, back to you, just want to get it done. And then there'll be those who really thrive when it comes to making revisions and sifting through the wreckage. In this room, how many of us really thrive when it comes down to weighing up the options and making a choice? How many of us are absolutely at our best when it's just a case of nailing down the commitments and getting it to happen? And the last one, who really loves that process of making revisions, sifting through the dust? And in many organisations, where we've been, in fact, systematically diagnosing execution success and failure on these dimensions, it's the making revisions piece which can be the most elusive. Now, in my very old days at the Boston Consulting Group, they were still just talking about the experience curve. Did you ever come across that? The idea that as you gained experience, you would move down a curve, so you'd improve on cost, you'd reduce defects, because you gained experience. And if you'd moved down that curve further than your competitors, you'd have a killer advantage. If you never made revisions, what would be the slope of that curve? It would be absolutely flat, and you'd never gain that advantage. Let's be clear, if we're dealing with a rather simple world, where we can see pretty clearly to the destination, don't let's bother with this. Why add difficulty when we don't need it? But if we are, as many of us in this room are, engaging in that world of VUCA, the more volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous world, and this is one we'll need to crack. Here are a few more that you might want to consider. Strategy communication. I would imagine that in a lot of the organisations in the room, we put a lot of resource into communicating strategy. Would that be right? Mm-hmm. Coffee corner meetings, town halls. And you may think it very odd, therefore, particularly from a strategy guy like me, I think it depends what we are communicating. And sometimes, in the name of communicating strategy, has anyone in the room ever come across something called a strategy house? I hate the strategy house. I wish to demolish the strategy house. Where is the dynamite? Because they're all the same, aren't they? So you always get the foundations, the pillars, And then you've got the roof. Then you've got the roof, and back to the Netherlands. One of our clients, ING, major Dutch bank, said maybe we should put a little chimney on top with the smoke coming out to show what everyone's been smoking in there. I'm being very harsh, of course, and indeed. This is the sort of thing that can serve as a placeholder. But on our execution programme, we had a very interesting conversation early on about this. And one of our participants said, look, and this perhaps might go against the grain for some of us in the room, he said, in truth, I don't need the people working for me to understand the strategy. He said, I want them to understand that we have a strategy. And he said, I also want them to understand that we got a good one. But what I really want them to understand are the priorities. And when we say understand the priorities, what matters, why it matters, to who it matters, for how long it matters, this is something that we call in the context of our program shared context, which again, if we're coming back, making that crucial connection, say, between sales and marketing, we're coming back to horizontal coordination. It's absolutely the driver making that possible within and beyond our own organisation. Now, here is the rub. We find that a lot of employee engagement surveys, and I bet everyone in the room has one of those, will ask this question. Do you agree with the statement, I'm clear on the firm's top priorities? And you'll learn that 84% of your managers agree. Big tick in the box, or what's a better question? What are the priorities? Indeed. Now, again, we're not wanting to get too anecdotal, and it's long enough ago that I can tell the tale out of school. A few of us from LBS were asked to do some board effectiveness work for part of the British Ministry of Defence, and it was what was then called the Defence Procurement Agency, which acquired and distributed defence material, and it had got into such a condition that British soldiers in Afghanistan were having to buy their boots on Amazon because it was taking too long for the boots to make their way through the Defence Procurement Agency. Otherwise, they were just having to go into battle in their trainers or something like that. So they sent in this remarkable guy called Sir Peter, who was an admiral from the British Navy. And he was one of these people who would come into the room and you'd immediately feel just a centimetre taller, and he'd say, are we winning today? And you'd say, yes, Sir Peter, marvellous guy. We then had to explore how well Sir Peter's priorities were translating onto the board. And there were 8 people on the board, including Sir Peter. They were major generals, terribly important people with what they called scrambled egg on the shoulder. And medals, and 8 people on the board. We asked them to write down the 5 priorities for the board for the year ahead. What would be the maximum number of answers you could get? 40? How many would you like to get if you were Sir Peter? 5. It came out at about 26. And Sir Peter started to get rather noisy at that point, as if he was commanding a frigate under heavy shell fire. You could try this at home. In fact, if there was one small takeaway from this session, which is easy to try at home in your own team. We're coming to the end of 2017. Good moment for testing New Year resolutions. What are the 5 priorities for your team? Ask each one of them to write it down. See what you get. Because on our survey, this is what we got. Less than half of direct reports could list 2 of the 5 top priorities. You probably think that's a bit unfair. So why don't we make it 3? Or even 1? Here's one which, again, you might want to give pushback on, because often you'll hear that execution is about doing the thing right. And I'm sure we invest a lot in Six Sigma. We've probably got black belts. But as well as doing the thing right, and this comes down to resource allocation in the end, which can be a bugbear in many organisations, which is to say, how dynamic are we in the way in which we allocate resources? And what we've got on the screen here is a piece from a report by McKinsey, dreaded former competitor of mine. But their magazine, their house magazine, McKinsey Quarterly, I would say is superb. In every quarterly edition, there's something well worth getting the teeth into. And these authors from about 5 years ago asked, what would happen if you never changed the way you allocated capital expenditure? So to avoid having a horrible fuss and complaints in the organisation, you just say to the guys, you can have what you had last year. And lo and behold, it turns out that the more you do what you did last year, so the correlation index of CapEx gets closer to one, the lower your total shareholder returns in this McKinsey sample. Not surprisingly, because with the world moving on, do we have the courage to make those changes in the way in which we're allocating resources? Or is it just easier to do what we did before, often for political reasons? And behind that, again from our survey, is something which leaps out, which is that the issue isn't getting resources to put into an initiative. This is why we were saying in many companies, investments rather like war. Easy to start one, but then the problem is it's difficult to get out of one. And this is the question of speed of exit. And of course here, what we're looking at is someone's baby, and you're going to be the person who says, I'm sorry, it's an ugly baby, and it's going to have to go. And this is not just about the misallocation of resource, it's the emotional wear and tear, the paralysis of the executive committee, as they struggle again and again with these dead ducks, which can't finally be dispatched. And again, in the survey that we run on our programme, we find that that issue of dynamic resource allocation, often in the end, coming back to courage and political will, tends to be one of the killers. Another controversial one, because after all, we want people to score goals, don't we? Kick the ball into the net, and we reward them. Because if we come back to the question of where our challenge lies, it might be a challenge of vertical alignment, which would come back to just do it. It might be a challenge of horizontal coordination, or it might be a challenge of change. And so in a classic performance culture, what we'd find is that the dimension that's getting privileged is the top one. And this is where we may need to be ever so careful of a one-size-fits-all approach. Because what we were finding in our survey was that of the respondents, about 7,500 respondents from different organisations, more than half were saying that experimentation and failure had hurt their career. 15%, under the heading of coordination, would say that they would address issues promptly if it hit their own numbers, but otherwise would not collaborate. And then under vertical alignment, back to scoring those goals, two-thirds of the sample in our survey, large sample, was saying that individual performance in their organisation was the top driver of promotion decisions. Now, let's be clear, if the challenge is one of vertical alignment, there is absolutely nothing wrong with what we've got at the top of the page. Far from it. It is what we need. But the danger may be when we find ourselves drifting into a one-size-fits-all approach, where in fact our execution challenge is more here or more here, and we're still adopting the same execution imperatives. Now, one final one, this is a final one to leave you with before we close at 4 o'clock imminently, is this. Do you know what? In my own business, I am so tempted to make that my precept for execution. Guys, I've had enough. Let's save time. I know. Of course, the issue is I don't. There's also, by the way, a saying which I think Steve Jobs stole from Picasso. Genius is rare. Genius is also mortal. So even if you did know, Fred, you're probably not going to be there forever to know. So the question, and this comes right back again to that quality of commitments, who are the holders of those commitments, the distributed leaders who occupy those key nodes in that network of commitments in our organisation. There may be, if you like, in some of our organisations, some no-brainers. So it may be that we've got great HR processes set up, which select on great and interesting criteria who comes to our annual off-site meeting, who's reviewed in the pipeline. But I particularly like, coming back to Steve Jobs for a moment, that last one. So if any of us in the room, were going to leave our current organisation and we had a free hand, who would be the 100 people we'd take with us? That's, by the way, raising the question, who would get left behind? But if we had that free hand, who would those be? Because those are probably the distributed leaders who command those key nodes of influence. So just finally, what you might want to reflect on, how far we might be inclined to some of the biases and how important it might be in the context that you've been exploring today in the other sessions to ensure that from an execution standpoint, we're able to find ourselves where appropriate, given what we're looking to execute around, more to the right. So, it's exactly 4 o'clock. I hope that's been provocative and most crucially useful. And if you wanted one small takeaway, do try that one with the 5 priorities when you get back home, because that might provide some useful insight for the year ahead. And because we're getting close to that point, I hope you have, as well as a superb weekend, a fantastic 2018 as you execute your strategies.
This lecture is from LBS Live at London Business School. Find out more about LBS's short courses at london.edu/executive education. And for more fresh ideas from LBS's experts, visit london.edu/LBSR.